Next, Bathroom Spears Broadsides. In fact, we're going to go right into it. So hang on to your hats. It's February 1st, 2nd. That's it. February 1st, 2007. Stay tuned. We have a caller, and we're going to go straight to that caller. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Robert.
Hi, Robert. It's Peggy Lee Kennedy in Venice.
Hey, Peggy Lee. Is it Peggy or Peggy Lee?
Oh, I'm not picky. You can call me Peggy.
Okay, Peggy. Well, welcome to Bathroom Spears Broadsides. We talked a couple days ago, and you've been on this show before, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, I have.
And you, in fact, are calling from Venice, California?
Yes, Venice, California.
And as I remember, you are struggling to restore, I don't know, to establish the rights of, street performers, of people who are simply trying to exercise First Amendment type activity on what, the Venice boardwalk area?
That, and we also document and report human and civil rights abuses against poor and homeless people.
And are you primarily located, you covering the Santa Monica Venice beat, or are you covering the LA Skid Row beat, or do you have another beat or both beats, or how beat are you?
Our beat, if you want to call it that, is Venice and Santa Monica.
Huh. So, you know, we've talked a lot about the Jones decision in Skid Row, or down on Skid Row, that actually your friend and, I guess, your attorney, Carol Sobel, helped to write, right? Or, in fact, was the principal author of.
Right. It's a landmark case, the Eighth Amendment.
Right, it was a finding that the L.A. law, which draconianly prohibits sitting, sleeping, or lying on any public sidewalk in Los Angeles, correct me if I'm wrong.
It's one of the city of Los Angeles's various anti-homeless ordinances, which are misdemeanors.
Uh-huh. And the... the law was actually, it was thrown out because it is too draconian, but in fact, the ACLU, which brought the suits, sought a kind of a nighttime exception, and only within a limited area. Is that right?
Well, I'm not an expert on the Jones case, first of all, because it's more centered around downtown, but it was really important to all of us, because the federal court it was heard in, the judge more or less scolded the city for criminalizing homeless people rather than helping them or, you know, helping people, you know, get into housing or services. And it's using laws, and in downtown they have private security. So they use the LAPD and private security to criminalize people and harass people. And the law that specifically, I don't know the municipal code offhand, I think it's 42-something. And what it is it specifically says you can't sit or lay. It's used as like an anti-camping law. And they have a similar one, a couple similar ones in Santa Monica, but...
Yeah, talk to us about... Let me interrupt you, Peggy, because I know you only got about 10 minutes or so before you got to rush off to an L.A. council kind of get-together. What you are currently engaged in a lawsuit. Tell us where that's at, and then tell us maybe where you're off tonight and what's in store for the Venice homeless at the moment.
Okay. In Venice, this is what's on right now sizzling, is a few things. The Venice Food Not Bombs, and as Carol Sobel, as our counsel, our lawyer, sued the city of Los Angeles. Part of it is free speech, but the other part of it is who they're applying this law to. And it's very specifically this one area of the Venice Boardwalk. The technically, the free speech zone is what it's supposed to be. Extends from the southern part of Santa Monica into the El Segundo, the border of El Segundo. But that's the technical area. It's not really an area, that whole area is not a free, active as a free speech zone.
Now, what is it?
Just in a short 2 miles.
Peggy, what is a free speech zone? In Santa Cruz, we have a free speech zone, which essentially is 4 feet by 4 feet near the bookshop Santa Cruz. That's the free speech zone.
Okay. Well, it's an area that's designated for First Amendment approved activity. Unfortunately, the city created a law to regulate it, which is a vending law. It is not a vending zone, it's a free speech zone. And it's a little confusing because the city council person actually put forth a motion declaring it officially a free speech zone, which is great, but then the law that came after that was a vending law. And it is kind of crazy, this vending law. And it's been used very specifically to target the people they want to get rid of. And originally, if you'd ever been following this case, you would see in the LA Times these pictures of people who were unhoused and were, you know, moving across the boardwalk into the free speech zone to set up their wares or their art or whatever they were doing to try and survive and or be political, you know, whatever they were doing in the free speech zone. Because as long as it's supposedly First Amendment activity, you could accept donations freely for it. It got a little confusing because the city decided they wanted to regulate it, really, to control. You know, it's about controlling public space, and it's about property value.
Well, tell me, what exactly?
It's a mess, so.
So what exactly, who did what to whom, and what's the lawsuit about?
Well, the lawsuit is about that the law is unconstitutional. It violates our First and 14th Amendment.
What is the law exactly?
The existing law, this is the second one they've come up with in the last few years. I myself was arrested for violation of the law on June 11th.
What is the law? I mean, more or less, what does it say?
It's a little confusing. It's about 5 or 6 pages of law. And then the Park and Rec Department, or Department of Rec and Parks, created a set of rules, which is another 6 pages, to regulate it. And it says no jewelry. You have to go buy a permit, and it's a little bit misleading. The permit's only $25. But the fact is you have to buy this permit, and then you put your permit, which is a picture of yourself, and a little permit, and you put it in this hopper. You have to show up once a week and enter a lottery to get a space, which is reserved. It's literally reserved. It's not a free speech zone because now you've reserved, by virtue of this lottery process, you've reserved a space in the so-called free speech zone. And the people who generally are able to show up for this Tuesday lottery and get spaces are people who are either have like 3 or 4 people entering the lottery for them to make sure they get their preferred space, or the people that, you know, that's all they do. Somebody who might work full time and is an activist and wants to go down and set up on the weekend can't very well go on Tuesday and spend 5 hours entering a lottery. So, I mean, it's kind of,
Peggy, let me understand.
Type of people.
Let me understand. Peggy, let me understand. This is
First
for
First Amendment people like us.
Peggy, let me understand. By First Amendment, I mean, I know up in Berkeley there is also Isn't there a lottery as well for commercial spaces along Telegraph Avenue? Are you familiar with that situation up there?
Right. That's what they've turned our free speech zone into.
Right,
quite similar to that.
Yeah, near the University of California of Berkeley, up in Berkeley on Telegraph Avenue, the first four blocks, you find a lot of street vendors, and there's a lottery up there. But you're saying that they have turned, let's say, the ability to play musical activity, the ability to give a speech against, I don't know, U.S. involvement in Iraq and the forthcoming invasion of Iran, all that is subject to a lottery, and you have to kind of fight with a pro-life advocate to, you know, whoever gets the high die roll gets to speak.
No, I'm not fighting with the pro-life advocates. Nobody's messing with them. They're doing whatever they want. They're getting away with murder. People like me have to fight with somebody who is selling pictures, selling paintings, or selling little artifacts that they've made that fits into the criteria of, you know, what their rules, and it's really ridiculous. It's based on utility, if it has utility, and then it says no jewelry. So I'm not sure what utility jewelry has, but a T-shirt evidently has utility. So the T-shirts that we make that says Free Venice on it, the front of it, or Food Not Bombed, we can't sell that because, or ask for donations to supplement our Food Not Bombs because it has utility. So it's, as you can see, it's a little confusing. There's so many rules, but basically it's about controlling space. And there's also merchants that are on the other side of the boardwalk, which are the buildings. The free speech zone is on the west side. And on the east side, there are shops there that sell sweatshop type T-shirts that are mass produced, you know, with whatever on it, you know, Kiss My Butt, you know, Shea, whatever. It has all these crazy T-shirts that are made in, you know, Singapore or something. So, but, see, our T-shirts would be competition to them. So we can't sell our T-shirts because it's fascism. It's led by property owners and merchants. And that's who speaks to the city council. And that's what's happening with the homeless, too. So it's not much different, really. And that's something about the meeting I'm going to tonight.
But really,
that is, we're waiting. I think we have till the middle of February to get the decision on that. That lawsuit where Carol Sobel sued the city on our behalf and a few other plaintiffs. And the other lawsuit that we're involved with, which is really great, which sort of I'm really proud of to be part of our Justice Committee, collected documentation, statements, and we actually found the people's belongings in a sweep.
Are you following any of this?
Let's see. When was it? It says here in the lawsuit it was September 2004. A sweep was done on Venice Beach, and all you know, the police came out in force and with lights, go get off the beach and go, and your stuff will be there when you get back. Just get off the beach, like it was like an emergency or something. And then they took 10 or 12 dumpsters full of people's belongings. I mean, everything, carts, whatever, underwear, pictures, ID. You know what a sweep is like, I'm sure. And they threw them in these dumpsters, 10 or 12 dumpsters, which happened to have ended up somewhere near the city council person's office. And we found the stuff amazingly and took pictures of it and took statements. And a lawsuit was filed again by Carol Sobel against the city on behalf of, I think, 22 people who were unhoused at the time. 15 of them remained, we were able to find, and a settlement is at hand. And the law got changed that they could not throw in a person's belongings away. They have to hold it for 90 days, which is a big deal for Venice.
That's great. I mean, we're trying to get Ranger John Wallace here to stop trashing local camps. And what he does is he puts a little notice on the camp, at least this is according to the secondhand account I got, saying we're going to come back
good.
And we're going to come back.
Notice is better than
we're
just
gonna,
taking it
we're gonna come back
it away.
And he says
but it hasn't really stopped them from throwing people's things away. It's made them slicker. You know, they they'll only
Let me interrupt you because I, you know, I'm trying to link this up to Santa Cruz, and
okay.
we're trying to get the same kind of action here. Actually, in Fresno, as you know, there was also a successful lawsuit. We had Mike Rhodes on from Fresno talking about a federal lawsuit. I guess was your lawsuit by a federal judge or a state judge?
This one here is a this was a city.
Right. So actually,
this one here, it's NOE versus the City of Los Angeles.
Interesting. NOE versus City of Los Angeles. We're talking with Peggy Lee Kennedy in Venice Beach. You know, is there a couple of can you give us a couple of websites that people can refer to in case they want to get more information on what you're talking about? Because I think at any moment you may just dash away, because I know you said you have to leave, be somewhere at 6:30.
Yes, I have to be somewhere at 6:30. Okay, let me just give you our Justice Committee website. And if you want to Google search it, it's Venice Justice Committee, three words. And if you want to try and find it, it's Justice, just like it sounds, JUSTICE, dot wet nostril. That would be WETNOSTRIL.net. Justice.wetnostril.net. Or try Google searching Justice Committee, and also you could put in plus pepper spray.
Okay, well, we're gonna check that. In fact, I know that you and I talked about this a couple days ago. Specifically, I may actually read some selections from the article you wrote there. And we've also got calling in later at your suggestion, Becky Dennison from Los Angeles
Can really,
down on Skid Row.
Yeah.
So we're hoping we can, you know, we can get some more details on that. I'd ask you more questions, but I'm afraid if I do, I'm going to make you late. Where are you headed tonight? What's happening?
Well, the city council person, his name is Rosendahl, for our area. Venice is part of the City of Los Angeles, and the council person that represents our area is created a Congress of committees, and there's a committee on homelessness. And I'm going to it, not because I like to, but because, you know, somebody has to go.
We talked with Tad up in Arcata, and he said that such committees, and I found this to be the case in Santa Cruz, are often attempts to either derail or to head off homeless activism, or else simply to provide a sort of a patina of legitimacy to a government's attempt to, in essence, put a label of we're solving the homeless problem on something they're doing, which has nothing of the kind, but simply furthers gentrification efforts and sets up some programs that pay middle-class workers to deal with a small proportion of the homeless population. What's the situation with this group you're working on?
I agree, basically, with that take on these types of meetings and committees. But on the other hand, I feel like somebody strong needs to go in and lobby against criminalization whenever we have an opportunity, because the bottom line is criminalization is inhumane. I don't really like that word, but for lack of a better word, it's inhumane. It's not a solution, and it's not cost effective. And if our city government or our county government or state, any of our local type governments are catering to the people who are saying, yeah, lock them up, shove them in those jails. You know, that's just a form of fascism. And if you could go and just fight the fascism in a very stern way and remove yourself as best as possible before you get into the co-signing of whatever they're doing. You know, it's not a fun thing to do, but, you know, I think that people should at least try and speak to this because they are the city's catering to the merchants. They're catering to the property owners that hate anybody on their block that might be homeless, and I know what this is about. So it's it's a bad thing, and you have to continue to try and fight it somehow. Otherwise, what are we going to do? Let them drive everybody into the sea or kill them in jail?
I want an update from you. Maybe, you know, we do this program twice weekly, Sunday morning, 9:30 to 1 in the afternoon, mm-hmm. and also, if you know, 6 to 8 on Thursday evening. So if you feel like calling in and letting us know what's going on, I think it's, you know, it's really a key area, Los Angeles, also San Diego, which I can't seem to get any information on, lawsuits that have prompted city attorneys and police chiefs in both those cities to, well, nominally declare they're not enforcing the sleeping ban at night in certain areas of town, although, in fact, we're going to learn later tonight, and you already know, that they have ramped up enforcement under other laws with the intention, apparently, of driving homeless people away so as to create a redeveloped zone and a gentrified area downtown. But the fact is, in terms
of... nightmare.
But they've gotten...
Wait till you hear the statistics. It's
yeah,
really
I'm really interested, and I'm going to be actually reading some of that stuff aloud because I did get an email from L.A. Ken activist Becky Davidson, or Dennison, sorry. But, this still is a victory. And does the L.A. Jones decision have any implications for Venice?
Well, people seem to think it does, but they're still, you know, they did the Safer Cities Initiative and they're applying it to Venice. It's criminalization on a platter, you know.
I mean, that really is what we should be talking about, is the Safer Cities Initiative. Maybe you can give us a call back on Sunday. We can talk some more about it.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, give us a call around like 10 o'clock on Sunday morning or later.
Okay, that sounds good.
Okay, we can talk some more.
All right, well, you know, peace to you.
Hey, you know, and kick a little ass with the city council member.
Yeah, thanks for saying that, I will.
All right, I want to hear the whole report. In fact, record the whole thing and we can play it on the air.
Okay.
Talk to you. Bye-bye. That's Peggy Lee Kennedy in Venice. She'll be back, if she's able to, sounds like, on Sunday morning when we'll be returning with a longer version of this show. Your turn to Free Radio or Freak Radio, and we're at 101.1 FM or freakradio.org. My name is Robert Norse. The name of the show is Bathrobes, Pierres, Broadsides. In the studio with me is meddlesome Matt Marks, who is... I don't know. What are you doing these days, Matt? You seem to be just maintaining a low profile. You didn't butt in once on this discussion with Peggy Lee Kennedy. Of course, I had trouble getting a word in edgewise myself.
Yeah, I try to leave it to the professionals, considering this is my first time on the show. In general, what I'm up to is kind of wherever I can get my hands dirty, feet dirty in local issues, mainly sort of like yourself, interested in the anti-homeless laws and anti... poor and really people in general. A Cabrillo student that when the semester starts will be trying to get a little more activism going on over there that is centered around our cause.
Yeah, I know we first ran into each other that I remember at the parking lot panic law, which became the parking garage paranoia law, the city council's law that makes it illegal to enter a parking garage unless you have a car or bicycle, and then only for 15 minutes. And you actually mobilized a number of, well, you brought along a number of students to speak about it at city council. And as a consequence of your pressure, our pressure, pressure from the downtown commission and from, strangely enough, and I have to give them credit, the American Civil Liberties Union of Santa Cruz, mainly Don Zimmerman, who kind of led the group, they, the city council and... you know, were able to rein in civil libertarian style of Ryan Coonerty, who is a vice mayor. At the time, he's just on the council, not a vice mayor, but he's since been appointed, or actually was voted in by the council to be a vice mayor. Parking lots were removed from the trespass law so that only one parking lot, the homeless parking lot, I call it because it's across from the Elm Street Mission where homeless people are served food every, not every night, but a number of nights a week up on Elm Street near the Metro. That lot is still part of it, and the four parking garages where if you walk in out of the rain, if you're a homeless person, that immediately becomes a crime. And even if you're reading a book in your car waiting for your kids to show up or accompanying your elderly grandfather downtown, it's criminal if you spend more than 15 minutes waiting in your vehicle, because you could, after all, be a terrorist, a criminal suspect, a vandal,
or some sort of unsavory person that we know frequent the downtown parking lots. I mean, you make one of these assailants of women that we keep reading about in the Santa Cruz Sentinel. That whole campaign really makes me a little ill. Not that there shouldn't be concern, and there's actually, I guess it was last night, there was a meeting in the community police room at the police station about the issue of safety for women after the highly publicized assaults on the West Side. And I'm not a woman, and probably I may well be more upset and worried if I were, but I have been talking to a lot of women who are homeless. Well, I've been asking everybody, almost everyone that I talk to on other subjects, what about this? Have you been assaulted? Have you heard of, has one of your friends been assaulted? Have you heard of some other person that's not a friend of yours that's been assaulted, who's homeless or poor? And so far the answer is no. And which makes me think, well, you know, that doesn't mean that, you know, we shouldn't be concerned about this. But the idea that suddenly, you know, it's time to ratchet up the police budget, you know, surrender the tattered remains of our civil liberties and just, you know, retire with shrieks behind the thin blue line of guns, badges, pepper spray, and tasers is just something that I'm not interested in, and I think it's really a bad way to go. What do you think, Mark? Am I just being an ancient civil liberties curmudgeon here?
Not at all. It's Matt, by the way. But
Matt.
Matt Marks. It happens all the time.
Fuck.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting when, I mean, they choose to sort of latch on to these things that happen, such as one single assault, which is in no way to, you know, to sort of whatever. I mean, that's a horrible thing, and we should be concerned about it, but it's interesting when you talk to the community and nobody's heard of anything else other than this one, and this is getting all this publicity, but how many people do you talk to that are poor and are homeless and are, you know, screwed every single night because cops can harass them and don't have a legal place to sleep, but these things we pay no attention to. You know, the things that sort of inhere within the system itself, those are invisible to us, but little things that the cops can use to get more money and to get more fear-mongering happen and take away more civil rights are front-page news and are reasons to have a community police meeting. And I think that's sort of just the way... not just the way it goes, it's the way that it has been going.
You know, it's not just, I mean, I want to give the devil or the Sentinel its due. It's not one assault, it's a number of assaults, but it's all headlined, and it's, I'm looking at the map on the Santa Cruz Sentinel website of attacks on women, and there were assaults December 15th, December 8th, January 13th, January 19th, January 22nd, January 24th, there were two assaults, 1:55 and 6:45 a.m., according to this. So I want to be accurate in my description of this. I don't know, maybe what's being proposed here is a form of community action which doesn't simply involve snitching to the police department about suspicious-looking homeless people camping in their vehicles. And we had this interesting discussion, which kind of leads us back to Tuesday night when you and I had our most recent encounter. Previous to that, we met at the Coonerty Bookshop, where we were, I'm not allowed in the bookshop, but I was outside the bookshop with a table, and we were attempting to alert the community that Ryan Coonerty, the vice mayor, was inside. He's the man who said it's okay to arrest homeless people for sleeping at night, even though there's shelter tonight for 5% of them, maybe, if they have the requirements to get into the armory program. Or they make it into one of the church programs, of which, again, it covers about 160 people out of 1,500 to 2,000 homeless. So Coonerty's understanding of this issue and his claim that it's everybody's civil liberties are intact, even though most homeless people can be arrested for sleeping at night because of a law he supports, the city law, is sort of strange. And we'll be having, of course, a round three of that particular tabling will be happening tomorrow for those who want to come down. 1 to 3, we got some hot soup. Jumbo Gumbo Joe Schultz will be whipping out the vegan food for those of you who want to come on down to the Bookshop Santa Cruz. And we're going to be encouraging people to, you know, talk to Ryan Coonerty, have him come out and explain in more detail how it is that Los Angeles and San Diego are apparently misguided in telling the police to stop arresting homeless people at night because they're afraid of massive lawsuits, that Santa Cruz is somehow immune because we are a progressive city which, you know, we do give out at least 60 citations a month to homeless people who have no shelter, but still that somehow that's constitutional and legal. And, of course, what this all leads to, I'm hoping, is we will have a sleep-in ourselves, which will be methodical, well-documented, in which the police will have the option, perhaps under Vice Mayor Coonerty's tutelage, taking care of everyone's civil liberties are taken care of as people are arrested and taken off to jail for sleeping. Maybe he'll provide some shelter space that we hadn't heard about before that might be available for the people that are told they are not allowed the most basic human function. And anyway,
hold on, to play devil's advocate, they are. They can do it all day, Robert.
Exactly. Now, that, of course, is the argument that retiring Judge Tom Kangaroo Kelly used in throwing out a lawsuit by Attorney Kate Wells 10 years ago when it was brought on this issue. But you see, the problem with that argument legally is that that was an argument by a local judge upheld by three local judges. Well, now we're talking about the Jones decision, which was a 2-1 decision by a federal court of appeals. This wasn't just a federal judge, as we have in San Jose, who could have thrown out that three-judge decision, although there's separate court systems. There's a state court system and a federal court system. But the federal system overrules the state court system in this situation. And so as far as that goes, insofar as the Jones decision has laid down a standard that says you must provide legal shelter before, there must be legal shelter available before people can be arrested. They may even be saying you can't even say, oh, we're keeping aside two shelter beds open for the 50, you know, for the 5,000 people here in NC. We can arrest any one of you because these two beds are open, so because we have shelter. No, you actually have to have a situation where the people have a realistic opportunity to get into that shelter before you can claim that they can't be on public property. I'm not entirely clear what is said on that, but it's at least that you can't arrest a person unless you have a shelter bed available. And I know that Santa Cruz does not. Even the shelter beds it has are closed after a certain time. So when the police come around and try to arrest people for camping, they can't say, oh, well, you either leave and go to the shelter bed or else you get a citation, at least not under the current system. They could change it. And we've suggested to Coonerty that they do that. They set up car parks, they set up campgrounds, that, you know, it's actually cheaper than ticketing people for sleeping. But so far, for some reason, just Ryan Coonerty feels that that's just not a good way to go. So maybe tomorrow from 1 to 3 he'll explain it to us.
Or maybe we'll change his mind.
Yeah, maybe a couple hundred people there with their sleeping bags on the sidewalk will change his mind. I don't actually expect that to happen because that's a major project, but you never can tell. I mean, of course, the result, what usually happens when we do these kind of protests is that people like Ryan Coonerty's father, Neil Coonerty, our new supervisor and the owner of the Bookshop Santa Cruz, when he was mayor, actually the year after he was mayor, after a series of protests on the sidewalk which tried to bring into force in Santa Cruz the decision, the so-called Tobe decision, which was then a decision that threw out the camping law in Santa Ana, a state court decision, which said you can't do it because it violates the right to travel, it violates the right to equal protection of the law, it violates the right to due process. And instead of then City Attorney for Life Barrasoni in 1994 looking over the situation and making some suggestions to City Council about how the law could be changed, as, for example, the Richmond City Council has changed its camping law and included the Jones criteria. A year ago, it made the decision you have to have a shelter bed before you can arrest someone. And admittedly, it's the first city that I know of that's actually written that into its law. But it did make that change. But in Santa Cruz in 1994, even though, you know, there were, this decision was law, or should we say persuasive precedent at the very least throughout the state, Barrasoni and then Mayor Kennedy held tough. And Police Chief Bassett, that was named the police chief at the time, held up. Homeless activist response was to set up a little cardboard structure on the sidewalk for 2 weeks. They called it the World Peace Vigil, and it was done by Robert Flory and Dave Jacobs. And police arrested, harassed, kicked people around, pepper sprayed BD Bob Duran. David Dumars. BD was his nickname, and all kinds of abusive behavior happened. And the result of all this, although there was a wellspring of educational activity and understanding in the community that what's needed was a lifting of the sleeping ban, at least in some areas, I think, the city council moved in to criminalize protest. So they put in the downtown ordinances, which make it illegal to set up a structure after dark, which make it illegal to lie down on the sidewalk in downtown Santa Cruz, even if you're not sleeping, at any time of the day or night, unless you know, you're having an emergency situation or have a permit. They made it illegal to sit down on any part of the sidewalk anywhere in the city. That part of the law was directly challenged with massive protests, massive arrests. It was overturned by a local court, and actually Kennedy and Rotkin and Matthews came back with a new law that said you have to be 6 feet away. Now it's 14 feet away, thanks to the current city council and the prior city council in 2002. They made it worse. So the result of all this attempt to bring these issues up is actually further criminalizing people who are even raising the issue. They made other changes in the criminal code. For example, it used to be that if they arrested you for misdemeanor sleeping, which meant prior to 1999, if you slept twice within 48 hours after 11 o'clock at night, that was a misdemeanor, a punishable by 6 months in jail and a $1,000 fine. And activist Sean Alini was arrested for that in 1997, actually 96, and they held him for 3 weeks in jail on $5,000 bail or some such thing. And he, but they wouldn't take him to court. They dropped the charges because they didn't want to. They wondered if a jury would convict someone for sleeping in a city that has no legal place for people to sleep, claiming that you can't sleep. Maybe you should move to Tacoma or something, or you know. Phoenix might be a nice place to sleep, or maybe, you know, swim to Hawaii, or get yourself get a job flipping burgers, make some money, and rent yourself a room, buy a nice little piece of property, whatever. So in other words, it's an issue we're going to be raising tomorrow, and I know that you're a working man, so you won't be there for most of the protests from 1 to 3 in front of Bookshop Santa Cruz, but you'll be there for part of it, perhaps?
Yeah, I get off work at 2, so I'll be hightailing it over there on my bicycle as fast as I can, and hopefully I'll see.
I know that you've spoken very articulately before both the Santa Cruz City Council and those loons, very actually genteel loons up in Scotts Valley, very well-mannered, friendly loons who run the Scotts Valley City Council and the police department. John Weiss, I think his name is the police chief. Nice guy, you know, at least he was very... He's more forthcoming than any police chief has ever been to me. He hasn't no arrests, just long conversations, although I haven't gotten back to him. I know that, and you kind of followed up when Scotts Valley passed its own anti-camping law, completely unnecessarily, without any language like the Richmond camping law has that actually would incorporate the Jones language and say, don't arrest someone unless there's a shelter bed for them to go to. Instead, it just said, no sleeping, no camping, no overnight camping in Scotts Valley. You spoke to the city council, and we actually played your analysis of that, and we also played your analysis at the Santa Cruz City Council, the Jones decision. Do you feel discouraged after talking to those two bodies? And
definitely. I mean, I was pretty surprised, actually, because I finally read the entire Jones decision word for word, and I was sort of excited and discouraged at the same time because the Jones decision seemed to address, you know, head on a lot of the issues that we've been talking about. They say that, you know, homelessness is often an involuntary condition and it's cruel and unusual punishment to criminalize an involuntary condition. And this is legal speak. This is legally, you know, not even morally. And, you know, that's exactly what they're doing in Santa Cruz. They, like you said, they don't have enough beds for the amount of homeless people, and yet we still say that it's illegal to sleep at night. And, I mean, the Jones decision addresses this head on. And, you know, the things that we say, such as, you know, they can sleep in the daytime, so it's not cruel and unusual, I mean, that really speaks to the lack of compassion that you have for these people, because you supposedly, a lot of these anti-homeless laws are actually, you know, supposedly for the homeless people themselves, to decrease recidivism rates and to increase motivation to get a job. And if we give them a legal place to sleep, then they won't be as motivated to, you know, change their life for the better. And, you know, these statements are given right alongside statements that this is a constitutional amendment. This is constitutional because we allow them to sleep during the daytime. And what does it say when the only time they can sleep during the daytime, and if they actually wanted to go get a job, I mean, the daytime is usually the best time to do that, in my experience. And also, you know, they say the necessity defense. They say that if you can come prove to us that you don't have, that you haven't had legal shelter space available that night, we'll throw out your ticket. So, look, it's not inhumane at all. But really, I mean, who wants to go through that process in the first place? And the Jones decision has language that addresses that directly, saying, you know, what kind of law enforcement, what kind of city council is this that is sending people to jail or citing people when they know they can't be convicted? Because as we see, there aren't enough shelter beds available. And, you know, in that Jones decision, it says, does this just amount to police harassment of a vulnerable population, which is what it seems to be. It's like, we're going to harass you, and, you know, if you do want to jump through all these hoops, yeah, it's a possible you can get this citation dismissed at times. But you know, all this language really reminds me.
Well, that's another claim by the Santa Cruz city council members, Mike Rodkin, or those who are defending this law. They're saying that, well, first of all, you know, there's a lot of messy campsites in the Poganip, and they showed a lot of nasty photos of in Scotts Valley campsites, and particularly Ranger John Wallace, who did a presentation last April before the Santa Cruz City Council at a daytime session on the second floor of the library, showed these, you know, grim scenes of, you know, poo and pee and old needles and nasty tarps and, you know, stuff that messes up the environment and is not particularly pleasant to be there and shouldn't be there. People should not be doing that. And I, you know, I'm reminded people, you know, by Pat Kittle and others, people who call in, who aren't entirely hostile to homeless people, but who are very, very much concerned about the environment, who say, if you're camping outside, you know, fucking camp right, you know, camp lightly, camp properly. And my response to that has always been, you know, yes, but don't arrest people for, you know, camping because they need to sleep somewhere. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I get into fights with people about that. But I think that the city could be setting up all kinds of programs, talking about, you know, they could if people are – I said that people can give out littering tickets, you know, rather than camping tickets. It looks like we've got an incoming caller. And you don't need to criminalize someone for sleeping, and Rodkin's response to that is, well, but you can't prove that they dropped the litter on the ground. And indeed, there are problems in dealing with, you know, troublesome folks in that regard, but you just can't have a blanket law that criminalizes sleeping. We have a caller. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Robert and Matt. Not Mark,
yeah,
but Matt.
I have a couple of comments that I'd like to make.
Go ahead. What's your name, caller?
Caller.
What's your name?
Caller.
You are a caller. Go ahead, caller.
Okay, well, first of all, just to jump on and stomp on your soapbox for a moment.
Okay.
It's like, I hear you make suggestions, but I don't hear you give any details about your suggestions. Like, how? And as far as, you know, outlining, okay, they could set up programs, but blah, 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 blah. And in this Jones Amendment, also, I don't hear that being detailed. Okay, so now I'm going to go and stomp on the other soapbox, and that is that I would suggest that they spend the night in a homeless camp or shelter or be required to undergo the whatever stipulations there are or submit themselves to the stipulations of being able to acquire a bed, you know, as a homeless person at night or sometime during the week. And I think that should be a requirement for all of the council members before they go out and make rules like this. And I think this also needs to be incorporated. What needs to be incorporated in this Jones Amendment is the fact, or talked about, maybe it is incorporated, is the fact that a lot of homeless people are working people, and so they do work during the day, and they just don't have enough money to afford shelter for themselves at night. And so if it's illegal for them to sleep at night, and they need sleep in order to maintain a meager pittance of wage during the day, then what does that say, I mean, about what their situation? I mean, a lot of people think of homeless people as maybe, you know, bum, grungy-looking people, but I can assure you, because I've met quite a few of them, people who are homeless and that are working two jobs, sometimes three part-time jobs because they can't get enough hours or their employers don't want to hire them enough, give them enough hours, so that they'll be required to pay them benefits. How about that?
Well, it sounds like we essentially agree that there's a greater problem here. With regard specifically to the Jones decision, unfortunately, you know, their only job is to interpret the law as unconstitutional. It's another branch of government that has to sort of provide the way out. In terms of me personally, I mean, I think there are a lot of other solutions. I've proposed safe sleeping areas that have porta potties, that have, you know, trash cans for litter. I think the problem goes so deep. One thing, I mean, the problem is really inequality, and maybe it's inherent in capitalism itself that we are going to have homeless people. But I think for me, a lot of it is a moral argument. First of all, from the social service standpoint, it just seems basic that if you don't have enough beds, you can't ticket someone for sleeping. So to me, the solution does seem to really, the first solution is to not be allowed to legally criminalize the act of sleeping. And then for solutions beyond that, I mean, I think once people have a safe and legal place to sleep, we can work from there. I mean, personally, I don't see anything wrong with people by choice sleeping, you know, wherever they want. And in terms of the littering issue, I don't know if this is answering your question, but in terms of the littering issue, you know, I think people say, oh, this is a big public health concern, or people are littering, and really it's just they don't, just because they haven't paid to erect walls to protect us from having to see their trash does not mean that they litter or are more of a public health concern than any of us in houses. And actually, I mean, from an ecological standpoint, the ecological footprint of your average homeless person or your average transient camper is far, I mean, I can't say enough fars, less than your average homeowner / using their car as their primary transportation. So I think that concern, in terms of providing a solution to homeless people as a public health concern, I really don't think there's a problem that needs to be solved there. If you want to talk about, I mean, so in terms of, are you asking for a solution to homelessness in general?
Well, no. Specifically to homelessness in general, because there are some people who want to be homeless. That is their choice.
And do you see anything wrong with that? I have a friend who's, you know, touring across the country on his bicycle and chooses to sleep in a tent all along the way. He doesn't take a dime from social services. He works, you know, whenever possible and helps out everybody along the way. And he, you know, he falls under the definition of homeless, and we criminalize his sleeping, and he's not a drain on our social services. He's an environmentally conscious camper. So in terms of the...
I don't have a problem with that at all. And in fact, I agree with you. One point to make is that I actually have seen quite a number of homeless people going around and picking up litter.
That's a good point.
Supposedly, people with homes chuck out. I mean, if they really want to ticket people, why don't they ticket the people who are chucking their cigarette butts out the windows of their vehicles or flicking their cigarettes out of their windows, which the fire blows into the window of the person behind them and burns them in the eye and causes an accident? I don't see that happening. But, you know, I'm just saying some of the solutions could be, say they set up a program like for camps, for people who have homeless camps. Okay, in order to stay here in this camp, you have to attend these education sessions and, you know, provide actual education sessions for how to camp, you know, how to clean up your gear, how to stow your gear. And if you don't attend, then you can't camp there. You know, if you're going to be in a camp,
you know,
that you have to provide a community service, such as, you know, picking up litter or, you know, helping empty trash cans,
you know,
downtown, or
caller, let me jump
whatever.
In here. Let me jump in here, because I think that's a great idea. In fact, that was the most recent modification of the camping ordinance happened after the Camp Paradise situation. Were you here when Camp Paradise was happening? Or
Yes.
Well, you may remember that this was a situation where there was absolutely no shelter in the summer for people other than, you know, a very small, I guess it was 40 or 45 people. And so the Homeless Service Center regularly sent people across the river to the so-called Camp Paradise, Larry Templeton's camp, which housed, I guess, 70 or 80 people at its height. And, you know, it had its problems. It also had a lot of supporters, and it had got a lot of positive press, and eventually it was washed away in December of 2001,
right,
by the flood. But and they provided the campers with, I don't know, a couple weeks in a motel, and then, you know, fuck you sort of thing. But the reality of that was they also was a change in the law made that because a thing called the Santa Cruz Service Corps was created by Paul Lee, a local philanthropist and homeless and author and homeless activist who dislikes me intensely, but I want to give him his due. I'm also a critic of his in some respects. But he said it helped to set up the Santa Cruz Service Corps, and that was a kind of a series of things where people, homeless people, could work, go out and do stuff. And we passed through city council, or they passed a law that, in theory, would have allowed the homeless to sleep in the parks for 2 weeks while doing a conservation project, kind of like a civilian conservation corps thing. But in reality, they included requirements for $1 million in liability insurance and all kinds of permits, environmental reviews. So it became, you know, no one ever applied for it because it was impossible to do. And it was a completely bogus proposal. And it's actually a part of the camping ordinance now. And it was the last change that happened. And my response to you saying, what are my solutions? Well, we're talking about a particular, Matt and I are talking about a particular criminalization of people, which I think you obviously need jobs, you need employment, you need housing. You know, you don't need shelters, you need housing. Fuck that shit. You know, but until that happens, you need to have, people have to have the right to shelter themselves legally somewhere. I don't quite agree with what Matt says, that you should be able to sleep anywhere you want and everywhere, but I think that you should be able to sleep somewhere, and that is not possible right now, and that's my concern. And so,
okay.
I mean, what are the solutions? We propose, we being the Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, the group I work with, dozens of different things of people that could have been done by the city, very cost-effective, ranging from opening up the top level of a parking garage at night for families to sleep in their vehicles and then leave in the morning, and the bathroom. I mean, it's not, obviously, it's not ideal at all, but it's an emergency shelter situation. You have a declared shelter emergency in Santa Cruz since 1990. I mean, that's been an ongoing shelter emergency. It's just been the case. It could be done in the parking lot of the police station. You could set up a car park, little car park areas like they do in Eugene. You could set up a campground in the Poganip at the clubhouse up there, Poganip Clubhouse. You could set up campgrounds in different areas at San Lorenzo Benchlands at night when people have to be gone by dawn. Actually, we had some, I think, activist Becky Johnson came up with some 20 to 25 different possible solutions, all of which were rejected by the Santa Cruz City Council.
Do you suppose it was because the city couldn't make money off of any of the proposals?
I think there is a tremendous fear of not so much of homeless people among the politicians, but of offending conservative residents and merchants. And there's also this fantasy about the magnet effect, which actually we found by which Mike Rotkin, who's, you know, I call him the shadow mayor of Santa Cruz. He's probably the most powerful member of the Santa Cruz City Council. He was the mayor 2 years ago. He's been a mayor 4 or 5 times. You probably know Mike Rotkin or know of Mike Rotkin. He propounds this view, which the city council's own appointed committees have found to be false, that namely that when sleeping bans are suspended, when sleeping is allowed for homeless people, that will somehow everyone in the area comes to town and sleeps on the streets. That was not the case in Miami, Florida, when camping was allowed under a court settlement in 1992 and again in 1998. It was not the case in Santa Barbara in 1986. It was not the case in Portland, Oregon, under the Wicks decision in 2000. Not the case in Austin, Texas. It's just not true. I mean, there are things that will help, you know, will encourage people to come to town, like if they, you know, the Jordan administration is driving everyone out of San Francisco, as they did in 1995, people come down to Santa Cruz because it's nearby. It's kind of like a haven more than San Francisco. But
right. So back to my question again, which is, so do you think that all of the proposals have been rejected because
they don't make money?
The city cannot make money.
Well, you know, that's
off
an
of
interesting,
any of the proposals.
That's an interesting. I'm sure that if they were money making, they might be more likely to do it. But in a way, they would make money because they'd be more cost effective than using the police to jail people or ticket people, you know, for things that they're going to keep doing, that they have
so
to do every night.
Have they done a study comparing what the cost is?
Yes.
In police time, court time, administrative time,
well, there was
in ticketing people versus instituting, say, a pilot program and monitoring that and seeing how much it would cost.
There was a study done by Mike Satterley, who is an educational worker in 1988 when I first began working in this activist road, and he found the cost of tickets was like $500,000 a year. They were ticketing more frequently in those days. And, you know, if you figure out how much it costs instead to set up a campground, it's just much cheaper. I mean, it just is. That's what he found. But indeed, the city council, middle-class groups headed by Sherry Connable, the Coalition for a Safe Place to Sleep, have tried to put these issues to city council in 1990. They proposed an area back of the River Street shelter area, which is now occupied by Page Smith Community House Transitional Housing, I guess it's transitional housing. And that was rejected by Marty Wormhout and John Laird and all those great liberals who are, great on gay rights, and I'm glad they are, but, you know, talk about local homeless people, and they just become extremely reactionary. And that's been the case, unfortunately, with almost every progressive, so-called progressive politician. Caller, I'm going to roll on you because I got another call coming in.
Yeah, right. I was going to say, well, thanks for taking the call, and, keep talking about the issue.
Hey, and thank you, and you keep calling in.
Sure, sure.
All right. Bye-bye. Phone lines are open, 427-3772. I'm expecting a call at 7:15 from Becky Dennison, the L.A. CAN activist down in Skid Row, who will be discussing the kind of crap that the Los Angeles Police Department, not unexpectedly, is doing to get around the Jones decision, even though they're supposedly abiding by it and supposedly not actually arresting people under the actual law that the courts found unconstitutional. Thou shalt not sit, lie, or sleep on any sidewalk in Los Angeles. Nonetheless, massive harassment is happening. And I think what I'm going to do here is go to an article that she sent me and try to, read it, in fact, and read it in preparation for her coming up. I also was going to give a call to our local activist, Phil Baer, who has been struggling for the rights of the community to get access to property stolen by the boardwalk back in 1933, the Tidelands parking area, which it's been making millions of dollars off of over the years, and which the city has a right to, reclaim for the community. But the courts apparently have rebuffed that. You may have seen it in today's paper. Maybe I'll try and reach him just see if I can get a very brief update, and then we can go back to the Jones decision stuff. Let's see if that's a possibility. We'll give him a ring and see if he's in. I want to kind of make sure we cover that at some point. He's a hard man to reach, so we may not.
Hello?
Is this the infamous Phil Baer?
Who?
Phil Baer, kind of like in the...
Oh, yeah, right. Hey, Robert, isn't it?
Yes, it is Robert, and you are Phil, aren't you?
Yes, though there's a whole lot. When's this thing supposed to happen?
It's happening right now. You're on the air, buddy.
Oh, we are on the air.
Yeah, so give us your shtick.
Can I ask you to call me at another phone, because there's a whole lot of background stuff here that I can't control?
Sure, why don't you call me on that line yourself? I'll give you the number to call in on.
All right.
It's 427...
427
FRSC, Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Which is 3772 for all of you listeners.
All right, I'll get right back to you in a few minutes. Hey. How's that?
Okay, but be advised, at 7:15 we have someone else calling in, so if you don't do it immediately, you're not going to get in. So you got to do it right now, pretty much.
Okay, 427 FRSC.
3772.
What is it in translated to numbers?
3772.
3772. I hope the line is a little clearer. I can barely hear you.
It could be the frog in my throat.
Oh. Okay. Call you in a minute.
Okay. Thanks, Phil. And Phil has been an activist who's been on some different sides of issues than I have. He's a big drug warrior, even though he's an old hippie. And I can never understand drug warriors, but... Well, I guess if you live in the beach flats and you see people shooting up all around you and there's violence in the neighborhood, you want police action. You don't want to wait for decriminalization of drugs and medicalization solutions, and that's quite really, that's understandable. You know, if your neighbors are getting shot down, or your kids are facing, you know, gang violence, which feeds on drug profits, well, it's a real situation. I also cover Iraq and what's going on there, because I'm so pissed off about it, and I think it does have an impact on poor and homeless people in Santa Cruz. So there's just so much to go through that is often not, there's no time for it. You know, the most recent thing in Congress was the kiss-ass resolution that says we don't like what they're doing over in Iraq, but they're having a compromise between Senators Warner and Carl Levin. They oppose Bush's strategy of sending more troops, but they're not going to cut off funding. Well, we got a caller. I'll cut myself off. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Yeah,
hey.
Me.
Hey, we can hear you loud and clear. Can you hear us?
Yes.
Good. So, Phil, I haven't even read the article in the paper except to see the headline, but you've been struggling, and others have been struggling, to restore the Tidelands and other parts of the beach boardwalk to the community for how long now?
Since about 97.
And give us the dimensions of the problem.
Well, it is a title or ownership dispute involving not only the what we think is the estuary of the river, that is to say that parking area along the lower river, but also now the entirety of the main beach area, which unbeknownst to most residents of this city is not officially owned by the public. It is officially owned by the Santa Cruz Seaside Company, and the public merely has an easement to it. So all of that is at play, and the contention from our standpoint is that this is tidelands, lands that fall below what is referred to as the historic mean high tide line. And the principle goes that all states own their tideland, that the original colonies own their tidelands, and it's a long-established principle that, in fact, goes all the way back to Roman law and can be traced through Justinian law, through English common law, and so on. And most nations in the world these days have exactly the same idea, that water is a public resource, and specifically tidelands, the area below the high and the low tide, belongs to the public. And so we are asserting that this was tidelands when the federal government gave it to the state, that is, upon statehood in 1850, when the territory became a state. The federal government ceded to the state all tidelands within the state, and those are supposed to remain public property forever. That's codified as Article 10, Section 3 of the California State Constitution. And so we are convinced that those particular lands are, in fact, these tidelands, and therefore properly belong to the public and not to the private sector, and that's the issue at hand.
So you weren't able to what happened in 1933 that challenged this perspective?
No, in 1933 there was a local court ruling that purported to clear title on behalf of the Seaside Company. So it is that 33 local judges' ruling that was the subject of the first part of the ongoing judicial process that happened a couple of days ago on Wednesday, yesterday. That dealt with the question of the validity of that 1933 judgment. We were hoping that he would void that judgment because of various inadequacies of the judgment, he did not do that. So, in a sense, we lost that first round, but what was left undetermined, he did not say that there are no tidelands within the area that is under consideration. He did not say that there are no tidelands and therefore the 1933 judgment is valid. He said, I'm not going to address the issue of whether or not there are tidelands within the subject property. I'm simply going to conclude that this was a valid judicial determination. But our point is that if, as we contend, there were tidelands within that property, then the judge has absolutely no authority to convey the tidelands to a public, a private party, because all tidelands are deemed to be inalienable, and there are various clauses in the state constitution, in the granting statute from the state to the city and elsewhere that forbid the alienation or the sale or grant or the disposing of in any means whatsoever.
But as it stands,
the language is very solid that right. prohibits tidelands from being privately owned. In
as
other
it
words.
Stands, Judge Burdick, who is the judge who made this ruling about the Seaside Company, which we should clarify is the boardwalk, the area that owns
yes.
the beach boardwalk, and Charlie Canfield is the main stockholder in that company or the
The president.
President of that company.
The ownership of the Seaside Company is one of those dark secrets. Nobody knows, to my knowledge, the nature of the actual ownership, and it is rumored that it involves, in fact, a lot of out-of-town owners, and there are various suspicions as to the nature of the ownership and where the money goes and so on.
Well, I know you've been...
The public face is Charles Canfield.
You're a resident of the Beach Flats, have been for, what, a couple decades at least?
Long time, yeah.
And I know that in the 1990s you were concerned about Canfield's attempt to push through the city council the Beach South of Laurel plan that would have realigned Third Street,
right.
And that would have destroyed a lot of housing. Canfield has actually purchased a lot of the housing and destroyed a lot of it already, and actually then resulted ultimately. It was actually a major issue in the last election of the 20th century. The 1998 election in any case.
Right.
And where does the city stand on this now? I mean, isn't there an issue that the city took up the cudgels under pressure from you and others to try to restore this property to public use?
No, I would not give the city that much credit. Basically, there was a give and take where a tentative settlement was arrived at in 98, when a council majority led by Matthews and Rotkin voted to accept this settlement, a settlement that we considered to be just absolutely insulting. But they agreed to accept that. Then there was that election in November of 98 that changed the majority on the council, and a new council majority composed of buyers, Fitzmaurice, Crone, and Sugar decided to reverse that decision about accepting the settlement, and that opened it up again.
Where are we now? 'Cause I've got
to... We are now at the point where that council majority sort of lost out in the next election, so we now have a council majority that would probably have never done anything about it whatsoever. And from the period of about 2000 until 2005, we were assuming that the issue was just pretty much dead in the water because nobody was going to act. And then to our surprise, it was the Seaside Company that actually filed the complaint to quiet title, named the city and the state as defendants, and that's how we got it into court.
Well, What's the next step? I got to go in about a minute now, so give me a 30
seconds. The next step is the determination of whether it's confusing, and I don't think it's actually proper, but the second phase of the trial addresses the question of whether or not there are tidelands within the subject property. In the theory, as I understand it, coming from the city, is that they could determine that there were tidelands within the subject property, even though the 33 decision granting title to the Seaside Company has already been upheld, so that the Seaside Company could be declared to be the owner of tidelands, but they would be tidelands nonetheless, so that the public would have certain guaranteed control over the usage of it. It makes no sense to me whatsoever, since I think that tidelands cannot be privately owned, and if you conclude that there are tidelands within the property, which I'm convinced there are, then you cannot, at the same breath, validate a judgment that ceded ownership of those tidelands into private ownership. So it makes no sense to me, and it's going to have to be sorted out in some kind of way, and we're hoping that this initial phase having to do with the 33 judgment will also be appealed. But the issue is by no means settled at this point. It's almost muddier now than it was before Wednesday.
Phil Baer, thank you for talking about this. I would take more time, but I've got another caller coming in on your heels here. I may try to get back to you on Sunday to get a more background or more foreground.
Yeah,
the
shocker to me is that we're talking about the entire Santa Cruz, quote-unquote, municipal main beach. And everybody in this damn town, I'm convinced, is of the opinion that we as the public own the main beach. That is not the case, and the public should be aware of just what is at stake here.
Thank you, Phil.
Thank you.
All righty. Bye-bye. That was Phil Baer, activist with... I don't know the name of the group he's working with, but he's been active on this issue for years, and he's been on this program a number of times discussing this issue, and hopefully we'll be on it again. In fact, I may call him again on Sunday because we didn't really have time to finish the subject. Where is the appeal going to lead? What are the appealable issues? What's the schedule for all this if people want to attend and check it out? And that's going to be coming up, and hopefully we'll be able to learn more about that. Coming up now, and I took longer than I thought I would, is respecting a call from Becky Dennison, and she actually drew to my attention an article from the Daily Journal, which reads as follows, by Annette Rubin, and I'll read it anticipating her call in. Since launching their Safer Cities initiative in early August, Los Angeles police have made 4,800 arrests on Skid Row. The program, police say, is aimed at making Skid Row a safer area. But opponents say the purpose is to clear the homeless and make way for development. As part of the enforcement effort, police say they have been targeting drug dealers who prey on the region's homeless population. Prosecutors also have been getting tough on drug sales stemming from Skid Row, an area in downtown Los Angeles that is home to the nation's largest concentration of homeless people. But some defense lawyers say their caseloads have doubled with homeless addicts who would have been brought in on possession charges just 6 months ago and are now charged with sales, usually of small amounts of rock cocaine known as crack. And they contend the district attorney's office no longer negotiates on drug sales coming out of Skid Row. According to 10 public defenders who talked to the Daily Journal, district attorneys now discriminate between a drug case coming out of Skid Row and an identical case coming from another part of Los Angeles County. This is a blatant DA policy that they are going to treat these cases differently, said a public defender, speaking on condition of anonymity for fear her comments might negatively affect her clients. It's not abnormal for the DA to have a policy, but this policy is about targeting the homeless in that area because the city is redeveloping that area. It's a policy to get people off the streets and into state prison. Into state prison, jumping right over rehab and jail. Prosecutors defend their handling of Skid Row drug sales cases, arguing that previously drug sales in the area were settled too leniently. Janet Moore, the DA's director of central operations, said her office doesn't have a different policy for Skid Row cases. Moore said prosecutors are taking
sales arrests coming from the area more seriously. I've instructed my deputies that I want them to take recidivism drug activities very seriously and that we will no longer roll over and give those cases away. We are trying to give meaningful sentences to these people, she said, but there has been no direction from our office not to plea bargain. Moore said her department is responding to dissatisfaction by the public about how the cases in the area were treated. Looks like we got our caller coming in here. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Matt and Robert. Hello?
Hi, Robert. It's Becky Dennison calling.
Hey, Becky. I've gotten through the first fifth of Annette Rubin's article in the Daily Journal.
Uh-huh.
And I guess let's talk with you about what's going on in Skid Row. First of all, you work with L.A. Can.
Mm-hmm.
What is L.A. Can?
The Los Angeles Community Action Network is a grassroots organization. We do community organizing, public education, leadership development, and public policy advocacy. And our membership is comprised of homeless and very low-income residents of downtown Los Angeles, also sometimes known as Skid Row.
And I know that, you know, we've all been very encouraged by the Jones decision of April, which we've been talking about on the air here. Even some of us worried that the ACLU maybe was selling out the people at the city with the proposed city council settlement back in September by saying that, well, we'll depublish this decision and we'll make a deal down in L.A., but at least the L.A. homeless will not be harassed from 9 in the evening to 6:30 in the morning in the Skid Row area. And the city council then unexpectedly rejected that decision. And we had a situation where instead the city attorney and police chief agreed unilaterally to supposedly stop arresting people for sleeping on Skid Row throughout for the next 3 months. Although, according to this article and according to discussions you and I have had and I've tied with others, intensifying and throwing many more police officers into that area and arresting people under other laws. Are they arresting people under the sleeping ban still to the same extent they were in the past in Skid Row?
They're definitely not arresting people at the same rates they were in the past for the anti-sleeping law, although they are definitely arresting people. And they often arrest people very early in the morning. As you said, the sort of three-month test period where people could sleep from 9 p.m. to 6 a.m. is still in effect. And oftentimes, right at 6, 6:30, 7 o'clock, they'll go around and make arrests for people who aren't up yet. But they're not doing that in nearly the high numbers that they used to. What they're really doing is using the anti-sitting, lying, and sleeping law as probable cause to be able to approach almost everybody on the street. And that's when they're arresting people for more serious offenses. You know, they'll search people and arrest for possession or possession for sales, things like that. But they're using that anti-sitting, sleeping law as the probable cause to search, which is really damaging.
Well, obviously, how can that law be a probable cause when, as I understand it, the Ninth Circuit's decision is currently published law in your area, actually in my area too, for that matter. Although we're not, you know, we haven't taken our law to court, but isn't the law specifically that? What exactly is the status of? I mean, is it illegal? Is it? Has an injunction been granted? Has a preliminary?
Well, what
what's
court,
happened?
What the court decision says is that Los Angeles can't enforce the ordinance 4118D 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, because it does not provide adequate and enough shelter for homeless residents.
It doesn't
say they can't enforce it at all.
And so they can. So what they do is they use it at other times.
Yep.
So in other words, are you saying they're not enforcing at night under other laws using the sleeping ordinance probable cause, but instead using that as probable cause during the day?
Yes.
So at night, it's a safe haven at night, or they're just going in and doing other things at
night?
It's a
safer haven. I definitely not say it's a safe haven because they're definitely still harassing people at night. They're just not using the anti-sleeping law.
Now, I've heard, you know, that Skid Row is thick with homeless settlement, although I've also heard from Peggy Lee Kennedy, who I talked to a couple days ago and we had on the show about an hour ago, that Skid Row has been largely cleared out during the day. There's been a massive removal of people. But I've also heard that in Los Angeles has all kinds of encampments all over town, visible encampments, not merely in Skid Row. Is that true?
That's absolutely true. You know, there's 84 or 88,000, I don't know what the most recent count is, but 80-some thousand homeless people in Los Angeles County. And only about, not only, but only about 5,000 homeless people downtown LA. So while Skid Row is always, you know, thought of and characterized as the place where most homeless people in LA are, that's not true. It's just, it's a very concentrated region where homeless people live.
Does the Jones decision impact the other 85% of the homeless people, or is it only everyone should just rush off to Skid Row and sleep there at night? I mean, what's the...
Well, in theory, that's true. If the Jones decision is specific to the Skid Row community, it's a specifically defined 50 square block area. So that, you know, some people who opposed the nighttime sort of safe sleep zone did that under the guise that, you know, somehow people would run to Skid Row and set up camp. That hasn't happened, and nobody with, you know, none of our folks expected that to happen. I mean, people live in the communities in which they live. They get maybe hopefully some basic services in the communities where they are. Skid Row is not, you know, such a great place to be that everyone's going to rush there just because they can sleep from 9 p.m. to 6 a.m.
So what are the police doing in other parts of the city? Are they continuing to enforce the don't sit, sleep, or lie law on public sidewalks?
Well, they do enforce it at times, but they use, you know, they use any quality of life codes that they can, and that's certainly not the only one. I mean, they use a lot of ticketing and citation for public urination and defecation, for littering, for jaywalking, you know, things like that, just to use tactics of harassment. In certain areas, they'll use the codes that don't allow people to sleep in their cars. For instance, in Venice, near the beach, there's actually a lot more folks living in cars, so they'll use that ordinance. I mean, they basically just use whatever ordinances they can to constantly harass and move people.
Now, how long have you been working on this beat, so to speak, yourself?
Well, I've been working downtown in the Skid Row community since 1994.
What's the story with Villagrosa, the mayor? I heard at one time he was a relatively liberal city attorney, or is that just a fantasy? I heard that he didn't want to enforce some of the sleeping laws in the late 90s and early 2000s.
Actually, that was our former mayor, our most recent mayor, Hahn, was the city attorney prior to, and yes, he was very opposed to enforcing these quality of life crimes. Because Los Angeles is so far behind in terms of providing basic resources, such as shelter, bathrooms, things like that. But Mayor Villaraigosa is a former, you know, what some people call liberal assembly member. He was actually the Speaker of the Assembly, and then he was also a council member on the east side of Los Angeles, I don't necessarily know that he was engaged in very much policy work that affected homelessness. He did do some good work at the state level. But since he's been mayor, he has been number one person in charge of creating the Safer Cities Initiative, which was to put 50 more police officers in a 50-square block area to basically remove homeless folks from the community.
That 50-block area being Skid Row?
Mm-hmm.
And is this part of a downtown gentrification project that has a name?
The project itself doesn't have a name. I mean, gentrification is definitely rampant in downtown Los Angeles and has been picking up steam in the last 4 or 5 years. The Safer Cities Initiative is the name of the supposed effort to improve the quality of life downtown, which is really aimed to improve the quality of life for the new rich residents.
So what's the status of, I mean, if the police are violating the Jones decision elsewhere in town, and it sounds like they are, they're even violating it in Skid Row by making some arrests at night, right?
I don't know that they've made arrests at night. I mean, they definitely harass people at night. They make more arrests in the morning time,
uh-huh,
right at that time where the time changes over.
So they are abiding by it then?
They are, you know, they are mostly abiding by the Jones decision because, like I said, it only said they couldn't enforce 24 hours a day, and so they're not enforcing 24 hours a day. And it only applies to the Skid Row community, so they're not in violation in other communities by enforcing the law.
And so is the claim, I mean, are other people taking up the cudgels for the, it sounds like, 85% of the homeless population that isn't in Skid Row and that is trying to sleep at night and that some of whom are getting tickets at night?
Well, there's people, you know, organizing in a lot of communities. I mean, I'm sure you just heard Peggy talking about their organizing and efforts in Venice, and certainly there's people organizing in Hollywood and in South Central Los Angeles and places where there's larger concentrations of homeless people. But the legal support is, you know, limited because the ACLU and a few other private attorneys are really the only ones working on these civil rights issues for very poor and homeless people. And so there's only so much capacity. And so, no, there isn't any legal action happening in a sweeping way throughout the city.
But isn't the significance of the Jones decision, at least at the moment, that it's published law throughout the nine-state area where the Ninth Circuit rules?
Yes, and people could file similar lawsuits based on that precedent.
Have you heard of anybody? Has anybody done that?
Not that I know of.
And, you know, I know that here in Santa Cruz we've heard from timid ACLU lawyers that they don't want to do it because an en banc, that is a larger panel of the Ninth Circuit, might overturn it. What's your reading on that, and what's the schedule look like that? I mean, I thought that en banc panels acted fairly quickly. It's almost a year now since the April decision of the three-judge panel.
It has been almost a year, but I believe it's only been more like 3 or 4 months since the City Council took its final action and decided to reserve their right to appeal. So it's been a very long, both legal and political process, and so that's why the appeal has not been heard yet.
What's your analysis? Of course, no one can tell, but I want to go back to this. We had on the show Gregory Afghani. You familiar with him?
No.
He's a writer for Counterpunch, a local activist in Los Angeles who was upset that the ACLU and the mayor and the police chief were all getting together to essentially depublish the Jones decision and establish a kind of an agreement on Skid Row instead of fighting to uphold it in a broader context throughout the nine-state region, where it currently is law.
Mm-hmm.
What was the feeling of the homeless community? I mean, there was a settlement that nearly passed the L.A. City Council and then failed because, I guess, conservative council members wanted even more of the loaf, right?
Mm-hmm.
So was this regarded as a potential sellout by people on the homeless side and by activists who were interested in seeing the decision expanded and at least implemented?
Well, you know, I think there was a combination. There was a lot of outrage. There was a lot of misunderstanding because there weren't any, you know, community meetings for whatever plaintiffs there were in the case. They weren't necessarily checking in with people in the community, and so really the decisions were made in a vacuum in settlement discussions, and so. Some of the things, and so there was a lot of outreach to begin with, and then there was also misunderstanding, I think.
You mean outreach or outrage?
Outrage, I'm sorry.
Gotcha.
Outrage to begin with. But there was also a lot of misunderstanding about the strength of the court decision that we thought was a very huge victory, and then as we started to learn about it and some of the limitations I've told you about it, we started to realize that the court decision wasn't as strong as we had originally thought. So, you know, it was definitely a mixed bag, and it was a confusing time, and there were certain things about the proposed settlements that we would hear through the grapevine that were definitely not acceptable to the community, and then there were certain things that got changed, and it was really just a time of confusion and also realizing that the court decision didn't get us nearly as much as we thought it did when we first read about it.
Now, L.A. Can is on the streets a lot, and I know that I've read in L.A. Indy Media large protests. Well, I'm not sure how large they were, but protests announced on successive, was it Saturdays or Sundays, at the police station or the city council offices, I don't know, denouncing this Safer Cities initiative and this massive infusion of police. And what I've been reading about, I presumably, is using drug charges to frighten and imprison people. For behaviors that are essentially non-criminal in many ways or minor criminal behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a protest movement going on? How's organizing going among the homeless? It's always, as I found in Santa Cruz, near impossibility. I mean, how are you doing in Los Angeles?
I mean, you know, we're a strong organization. We have about 300 members that include homeless folks and extremely low-income folks who live in Skid Row. And so we have had a series of, I would say, very successful protest actions, and we're also doing street outreach on a daily basis to make sure that people can resist and stand up and protect their rights so that the police don't just roll over folks without any resistance. And I think there is good resistance on the streets. I think folks are exercising their rights quite regularly and coming together to protest at Central Division and City Council and the Police Commission. And, for instance, the Police Commission opened up an investigation on the use of force on the new policing in Skid Row. We got good media around some police abuse cases, which pushed the Police Commission to act a little quicker. And also, we were able to get the attention of the public defenders, who now have brought out this additional piece of information about how people are being set up for sales cases and receiving more punishment, which we also hope will prompt some action. And so, you know, it's a huge struggle to fight the millionaires who are trying to redevelop downtown and really need to eliminate homeless folks as fast as they can. But we feel like there is a huge force of resistance, and there is beginning to be a shift in the tide.
Is this decision usable in other localities? I mean, we talked about this a little bit before. You mentioned you don't know anywhere it's being used. Neither do I. If other communities wanted to use it, I mean, communities like Richmond have actually incorporated language, you know, about the decision. I don't know if you've heard about that. Have you heard about the city of Richmond?
I haven't.
City of Richmond in June of last year, under pressure from attorneys and activists Susan Prather and Elisa de la Piana and others, incorporated into the Richmond's camping ordinance the language that there shall be no arrests unless shelter beds are available.
Hmm. Well, that's great.
To the first, you know. But I'm wondering, in terms of, let's say, an individual defending herself in court from a charge of camping, in, let's say, anywhere in the nine-state area, can they just whip out this decision, walk into court, and say, what about this, even though it, you know, refers only to L.A. and Skid Row and Knight? Is that something that you... I know you're not an attorney, but
I'm not an attorney, but you know, we do work with attorneys in our legal clinic, and we're actually just beginning to add more legal support for these quality of life offenses.
Right.
I mean, so I don't know that, but I do know, yes, that the necessity defense is a proven and fairly effective defense.
Right, but that's a hard defense and requires, you know, showing six different affirmative conditions. I'm talking about just citing this court decision and saying, look, these laws are unconstitutional because this jurisdiction does not provide shelter. And, you know, I mean, in other words, does this decision put us any further than the necessity defense elsewhere other than in Los Angeles, is my question?
Well, I am not an attorney, but my guess is no, because it doesn't even apply to all of Los Angeles yet. So, but again, I'm not an attorney. So
you're not telling me what I want to hear here,
I know.
Nikki. Wow.
Like I said, while it was great precedent, the decision itself, and we certainly wanted to stay on the books and not be, you know, like it was published that, or sort of leaked that it was going to be removed from the books, we would not support that. It's great precedent, but it is not a sweeping decision. It is solely focused on this 150 square block area. So it's not like you can just whip it out and use it wherever you want. You'd have to challenge laws using it as precedent.
But a lot of the language has some, you know, I mean, it is precedent in this area, right? I mean,
it's great precedent. It's great legal precedent, but it doesn't necessarily
cover
transfer
every law
to immediate impact.
What can people do up here in Santa Cruz to help you down there? It sounds like you're helping yourselves and doing a great job, and we should be helping ourselves up here. But let me ask, how can people get more information about what's going on down there? I know that LAND Media is one place to go, although not much new has appeared in the last couple weeks. There were a couple stories that showed up. You've mentioned, and I will mention after we get off the air, the story that you sent me and the LA, was the LA Weekly and the Daily Journal.
I think the LA Weekly and the Daily Journal article are the best articles that have been written about this situation. Everything in the LA Times has been very, you know, whitewashed and very developer and police friendly. You can also certainly go to our website at www.cangress.org, and people can contact us at any time. And in terms of, you know, support, obviously, you know, any support we can get in sort of media outlets outside of Los Angeles and community-based organizations and what have you is more than welcome. But yeah, obviously we are definitely going to have to support ourselves and help ourselves because we're in the midst of it on a daily basis. But we would definitely welcome any support if people want to call us or email us.
And that's www.cangress.org.
Mm-hmm.
C-A-N-G-R-E-S-S.
Yep.
Well, if you happen to be up in Santa Cruz tomorrow, you can drop by the Bookshop Santa Cruz, or the BS Santa Cruz, as we like to call it, where we're going to be doing a protest against, one of the part owners of the store, or one of the workers there whose father owns the store. He was also vice mayor of the town and has passed anti-homeless laws and upholds our own sleeping ban law because it says it's okay in Santa Cruz to arrest people for sleeping because you can sleep during the day, even though you can't sleep at night.
Well, good luck with that, definitely. And anything that we can do to support as well, please let us know.
I will. We've been talking with Becky Dennison of LA CAN, which stands for?
The Los Angeles Community Action Network.
That should be simple enough. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
All right, thanks
talk
for coming
to you
on.
Soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And phone lines are open, 427-3772. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. In the studio with me is Matt Marks. I'm Robert Norris. And now's your opportunity for the next 20 minutes to call in and rage or teehee or just make comments about anything you've heard. And if I don't hear anything, and I probably won't, at least I haven't yet, I am going to go back to this article I was reading. Let me ask Matt, do you have any comments?
Slightly disheartening conversation to hear. I mean, I've been putting in a lot of work towards getting Jones decision language put into the books up here in Santa Cruz, and it sounds like even down there, even in the one little area where the Jones decision does affect on Skid Row, the sort of, it's a big court battle victory, but yet the actual effect in the streets is police using other laws that they have at their disposal that the Jones decision says nothing about to continue to harass homeless people. And it sounds like they've almost like ratcheted it up a little bit, almost like the hit of the Jones decision and the force needs to, you know, maintain this power control and sort of ratchet up. Well, okay, you guys can have that, but boom, look what we're going to do. And it, you know, it causes me to question and to just sort of examine the way our sort of avenues of affecting change, and you know the legal avenue needs to be one, but they're also, you know, what we learned from watching the thing at UCSC the other night with Cop Watch and Mike Rotkin, there are a lot of things that need to be done, such as community organizing and getting people to actually stand up to the police in the streets no matter what it says in the courts, because the cops are always going to have these little things that they can do, and if they want to mess with you, and if you're part of a vulnerable population, such as homeless, poor, people of color, then they can and will. And, you know, we need to do, I guess, more than just these sort of big legal battles that make front page news and sort of seem like, oh, these activists have a victory, when really, in reality, on the streets, nothing happens, which is sort of, you know, I'm very young, but it's freaking way too common in sort of the activist life, is these things that are supposed victories, and then we realize that they have less effect than they seem to have in the first place.
Let's delve more deeply into the gloom here. The Daily Journal article by Annette Rubin, yes. I was reading it before, again, talks about how the police are, the DA's office suddenly using a new policy of not plea bargaining, higher penalties for crack cocaine for small quantities, even if it's not being sold, but it's being possessed. I'm going to read a little bit more about this. Jenna Moore, the DA's director of central operations, said her office does not have a different policy for Skid Row cases, said prosecutors are taking sales arrests coming from the area more seriously. That we have no direction from our office not to plea bargain. She said her department is responding to dissatisfaction by the public and police about how cases from the area were treated in the past. Much of that dissatisfaction followed media reports about major offenders who received lenient sentences. But public defenders say these are not the people affected by the new strategy. My caseload 6 months ago was primarily violent and serious predators, people
most would agree should be locked up, said Deputy Public Defender Jack Keenan. Keenan said that his caseload has doubled to 50 and that they are now almost exclusively drug cases from the Skid Row area. He said his clients generally have no prior sales records and are charged with selling small amounts of crack to undercover cops. We're taking in the neighborhood of $2 to $20 worth of crack, he said. Typically, I get a guy who's a user. In fact, that person is usually on probation for possession. Police officers will ask him where they can get a rock. Most often, this guy will break off a piece of his own and sell it. Public Defender Robert Hill said the DA's office used to make a distinction between minor sales cases and serious dealers, but that policy has changed. I was told by the DAs they would love to negotiate to give us a reasonable offer, but they can't because the police department is watching them, he said. Cases that would have settled early and easily are settling later or going to trial. He said those affected by the new policy are the lowest level addicts selling for a chip of rock. But they're still getting prison offers, he said. That is something that would never have happened before. They would have gotten probationary offers. A first-time sales case, even if it goes to trial, doesn't necessarily mean a prison sentence if the defender has no criminal record, according to public defenders. A defendant with no record could get 180 days in jail at trial. But homeless addicts are likely to have a record, and public defenders say many of their clients are on their second sales arrest, each involving small amounts of drugs. Sentences for drug sales range from 3 to 5 years. Deputy Public Defender Lisa Lichtenstein said each sales conviction means a 3-year sentence enhancement. If they have a sales prior, add a 3-year sentence enhancement, so their maximum jumps to 8 years. If they've been to state prison, that goes up. That's how the maximum gets huge, she said. It's hard to tell someone that their maximum is 22 years when they have no violent history. Constance Rice, an L.A. civil rights lawyer, said such a strategy by the DA's office could raise equal protection and due process concerns. If you decided to only offer probation in the Valley and not in South Central, you could raise an equal protection argument, Rice said. There is prosecutor discretion, but are they exercising that discretion in a way that doesn't have an adverse impact on class or race? Rice notes that Skid Row is disproportionately African-American men. Moore insisted, she's the DA, that cases from Skid Row were once settled too easily. It has been more lenient here than in other areas, she said. At least that's the public's perception. She said the department did a comparison a few years ago. We were not the most lenient of all the courthouses, she said, but we were certainly below average. One way public defenders say these cases are being handled differently is exclusion from early disposition court, where defendants who want to plead guilty can avoid trial. The incentive is a lesser sentence. For non-serious cases, that's where you're likely to receive the best offer, Merle Lottman, a deputy public defender, said. Lottman is one of a handful of public defenders assigned to early disposition court where, he said, Skid Row drug cases no longer end up. Now these cases are going to preliminary hearings court, he said, because the judge is more likely in early disposition to undercut the DA's offer. But Moore said, that's the DA again, that there is no policy to keep these cases out of early disposition court. To say we are not participating in the early disposition process is just wrong, she said. Because the district attorneys typically are offering prison time for Skid Row drug sales cases, many defendants opt to go to trial, said Deputy Public Defender Rigoberto Arachiga. I completed one of these trials in December where a guy had a minuscule amount, no money on him, no phone or pager, no individually wrapped drugs in multiple bags, just some rock cocaine in his pocket. The guy had no prior record of sales. Arachiga said he got 4 years in state prison. The offer before trial, he said, was 3 years in state prison. On possession, a person is eligible for treatment programs, he said. 9 months ago, even as a sales case, we would have been allowed to go to early disposition court. But Moore said you have to look at the history of the individual, even if someone has no prior drug sales. Has he been on probation? That's the kind of stuff they got away with in the past that we're being stricter on, she said. Like many public defenders handling these cases, Arachiga believes the LAPD is turning possession cases into sales cases to ensure stricter punishment. If a person has a rock but no pipe, that's an indication that it's for sale and not personal consumption, he said. They give a lot of weight to an officer's opinion, and lately it seems that every officer's opinion is that everything they find in Skid Row area is for sale. Everything is a sales case.
Of the 1,400 arrests made by undercover narcotics officers for drug sales since the initiative began, 1,093 were categorized as possession for sale. These cases are treated like any other sales case. If the defendant was charged with possession, he likely would get a combination of probation and treatment. But Central Division Patrol Captain Jody Wakefield said her uniformed officers are making plenty of possession arrests. She said that since the Safer Cities Initiative started, they have made 630 arrests for possession. She said the drug sales cases have gone up because Central Division has increased its focus on sales. We put a large contingency of narcotics officers in the area, Wakefield said. So, yes, their caseloads would double. Arachega said most of his clients are homeless veterans with psychiatric issues. That's the bulk of my clients downtown, he said. As many as one-third of Skid Row's homeless have mental illnesses. Many of them have what psychiatrists call a dual diagnosis, mental illness counted with drug addiction. They are likely to sell small amounts of drugs to support their own habit. Wakefield said her officers are aware that many of the sales arrests they make are people selling a rock to get their own. She said her officers are focusing on those drug dealers who prey on the homeless, as they have said publicly when discussing the initiative, but that they're also focusing on all illegal activities out there. If they have a narcotic and they're selling it to someone, is that not a drug sale, she said? Where do you draw the line between who's a dealer and who's not? Keenan said officers don't seem to be going after the big sellers. The biggest complaint we have is, okay, you caught this guy, ask him where he got the drugs, and then follow that guy to the house the rock came from, he said. They don't follow the chain, and a lot of this is due to business owners who want this blight off the street. I can't disagree with them for wanting to get rid of blight, but for the police to say they're going out there to get the people who prey on the homeless is just a mischaracterization. At this point, they're the ones who seem to be preying on the homeless. But Wakefield insisted her officers are trying to, quote, catch the big fish. We have made some very large arrests, she said. We are following up any time we can. A lot of the time, the person who is caught doesn't want to give up that name because they know they have to go back on the street and they don't want to get hurt. Arachega said he was surprised by the kind of resources the LAPD allocates to these kinds of cases. In that December trial, it came out that there were 24 officers involved in that sting, he said. That floored me. 24 officers for that amount of cocaine. That's a minuscule amount of cocaine in somebody's pocket. Public defenders question whether this type of policing is wise during a time when gang violence is up in the city. If you're trying to stop the sale of drugs, Butko said, you're not going to in this fashion. Wakefield said she would welcome feedback from public defenders. How are we going to be made aware of things if they don't come to us, she said. She strongly disputed accusations of wasted resources. She said undercover operations are dangerous and require more officers. And it's not about the $10 rock. That $10 rock, she said, it's about the effect on the entire area. They know we're out there and we're watching. She said police efforts have made a big difference downtown. That, again, is a Daily Journal article by Anat Rubin, Daily Journal staff writer. You can probably go to the L.A. Daily Journal and check it out.
And, I mean, that last part is just such bullshit. I mean, they know we're out there and they know we're watching and they know that there's absolutely no help coming from you. There's 24 officers undercover, which is a larger pay rate. That, I mean, all this money being spent on knowing that they're out there and watching, and a minuscule in comparison amount of money being spent on actually dealing with the issue. And I think, I mean, we have the priorities are in completely wrong places. Let's continue doing what we've been doing for the last however many years as drug use continues to rise and the money allocated to fighting drug use in the exact same ineffective way also continues to rise.
And it's the use of the drug war to gentrify the downtown and to go after a target population, in this case African-American men, homeless vets with psychiatric problems. Here's a story from the L.A. Weekly that was also recommended. It's called Dissonance Between a Rock and a Hard Place. The L.A. Times coverage of Skid Row crackdown is an early Valentine to cops by Mark Cooper. Looks like the L.A. Times has found a creative way to help satisfy its profit-hungry bosses at the Tribune Company. It's apparently shifting the cost of some Metro reporting to the LAPD payroll. At least that's the sensation I got from reading last Saturday's cheery story from staff writer Richard Winton as he breathlessly listed the supposed successes of the now five-month-old LAPD Safer Cities crackdown on Skid Row. If Chief Bratton doesn't already have Winton on the pad, the Times ought to send him over an invoice. relying primarily on self-serving statements from a police captain with no actual reporting that can be detected by the naked eye, Winton declares the crackdown a clear success, writing, among downtown residents and advocates for the homeless, there is consensus that the 50 extra officers the LAPD assigned to the district have improved the situation, though they say the area remains mired in poverty, blight, and drugs. The Times staffer detected this consensus, it seems, by quoting two representatives of the business lobby, the police captain, and one relief mission official who gives a mixed review to the enforcement operation. I read the piece quickly, filed it under stenography journalism, and quickly forgot about it. That is, until 2 days later, when the Daily Journal reporter Annette Rubin took on the same story and seemed to be reporting from the other side of the moon. She got the real story, a big, fat, juicy, and important story, and one that the Times completely overlooked in its rush to publish a puffer. In an urgently written dispatch quoting nearly a dozen L.A. County public defenders, Rubin portrays the same Skid Row crackdown as a cynical and discriminatory push to consciously overcharge and jail the local homeless population in order to make the nickel safer for commercial development. The public defenders allege that the LAPD is a coordinated strategy of turning simple crack possession arrests into serious multiple felony narcotic sales raps, exposing a primarily mentally ill community of users to long prison terms. And they say the DA's office is playing along with the cops. The result? An outrageous policy that treats minor crack possession cases arising from Skid Row in a much different and more severe manner than similar arrests anywhere else in the city. Those arrested are predominantly homeless vets who are often caught selling half of their personal rock to an undercover cop, accused as dealers with a prior bust on the record that could do 8, 10, or even 22 years in state prison instead of getting the probation, drug treatment referral, or short county jail sentence that other small-time users get. The Times, again apparently quoting police sources, dutifully reports that the operation has, quote, resulted in more than 1,000 drug arrests alone. So? Rubin of the Journal, however, does the real work and unpacks in rather harrowing detail those seemingly glossy numbers. Of the 1,400 arrests made by undercover cops since the Skid Row sweep began last summer, Rubin reports a mind-blowing 1,093 were categorized as cases of possession for sale. Think about that for a moment. The LAPD and the DA are claiming that they busted more than 1,000 dealers in 5 months in one small area of the city. Who does that leave as their client base? Unless I'm missing something, the cops' own stats give the lie to the official version. Rubin also talks to the cops but goes beyond quoting their prepackaged spin. Central Division Captain Jody Wakefield is amply quoted in the Journal piece, defending the program, denying the cops are overcharging the homeless users, but then admitting that many of the arrests for sales are indeed people selling a rock to get their own. In other words, they are not dealers. They're just very poor addicts selling a sliver of their own meager stash to a narc. The folks quoted in the Times article, the downtown business reps and lobbyists, of course, think the crackdown absolutely rocks. From their perspective, whatever gets the homeless crack users off the street can only be good for business. Who cares if a couple of hundred crack-addled Vietnam vets are getting unjustly sent up the river? We, the rest of us who live in the city, however, ought to care a lot. And not just out of basic human decency and respect for equitable application of the law, which should be but never is enough. If the version of events reported by the Journal is anywhere near accurate, the city and LAPD are displaying extraordinary resources at public expense to clean up Skid Row for a few dozen toy wholesalers and a handful of loft and condo developers, while other parts of our town are increasingly submerged in the deadly dance of gang warfare. Our state prison system is bursting at the seams in danger of a federal takeover, all while the ill-named Safer Cities crackdown streams hundreds of the homeless into the same system for extended stays. I'm generally a supporter of both Mayor Villagrosa and Chief Bratton, but on this one, they owe us a much better and more forthcoming explanation of what's really going on Skid Row. We're certainly not getting it from the Times. And that is a story in the LA Weekly, which you can get online, Between a Rock and a Soft Place by Mark Cooper. So we're almost out of time here, but this kind of reminds me of Shanna Banana journalism that I read in the Santa Cruz Sentinel. Shanna McCord, as I call Shanna. Actually, she calls herself Shanna McCord. I like to call her Shanna Banana. A slippery writer, I don't know. Should be looking into things when she's, you know, having a lunch break. It's hard to think of why. Maybe I just like the name Banana and rhymes with it's a way of remembering it's Shanna, not Shana or Shauna.
She's done a couple of articles on medical marijuana in the last couple of days on the front page of the Sentinel. And she actually, I talked to her about one of these articles. What you'll find missing from those articles is any reference to the fact that our DA, Bob Lee, and his underlings uses a standard of prosecution in prosecuting people who supply medical marijuana that would make illegal every single distribution center in the state that is not a collective. So, for example, WHAM would still be legal if you're a care provider that is directly and closely involved with the people you're supplying marijuana to. But if you were simply selling it to someone who walked in with a marijuana card, that would be illegal. And that is the argument that is made by DA Bob Lee's prosecutors in the Roger Mensch case, and I believe they're probably making the same argument in the Hoey case. And those are both recent marijuana seizures where the people, Roger Mensch runs a thing called the Hemporium in Felton, and I don't know what Mr. Hoey does, but he is. Both of them were defended by attorney Ben Rice, who I spoke with on this issue. McCord, nowhere in her stories, brings out the fact that it has been openly acknowledged by the DAs of our county that they don't feel that they have to abide by Proposition 215 or SB 420, at least in that they feel Greenway, the club downtown, and all clubs throughout the state are illegal. Now, you would think that if they think that, then why don't they go after the main drug distributors? Go after these clubs. Now, admittedly, the clubs are within the city, but that's still within the jurisdiction of the district attorney's office. And the answer is apparently that they have some sort of political deal with these clubs, or they have some sort of political deal with the city where it's okay, you know, for people to go to the clubs, but it's not okay for them to go to clubs in the county, only in the city. It's a strange, I don't understand it, and I don't understand why the Sentinel is not writing about it, even though it's in all the court, it's in the court documents that involve these folks. I'm running out of time, so I'm going to sum up and take off. I want to invite people to come to the protest tomorrow in front of the Bookshop Santa Cruz at 1 o'clock. There's going to be some hot gumbo, jumbo, gumbo soup. Joe Schultz will be providing it. That's the guy who was featured in the Metro Santa Cruz. Or was it the Good Times? I don't know, one of those weekly rags. I'll be talking more about this and other things on Sunday. We'll be reviewing, Matt, the trying to play much of what happened on Tuesday night at the Tactical Ice Cream Squad presentation on how to know your rights. So Mike Rotkin will be heard debating with maybe with both of us a little bit as we heckled him from the audience. More heckling is what we need here, I'm afraid. So come back again, 9:30 in the morning. Actually, I may be in earlier with Thomas Levitt in the wake-up call doing some archival tape listening. And if you show up tomorrow, we can whoop it up in front of the Bookshop Santa Cruz and try to get old Ryan Coonerty to come clean. I should say young Ryan Coonerty to come clean and describe exactly how it is that sleeping during the day is okay and a good reason for arresting people for sleeping at night. Let's change the habits of them nocturnal homeless. Matt, thanks for being on the show with me tonight.
Thanks for having me. And be sure to come tomorrow if you're just looking for a free bowl of vegan soup.
Hey, it's good. See you then, and if not, we'll be talking on Sunday at 9:30. Stay tuned, and give a call off times if you've got some reports from the street to 423-HUFF, 423-4833.
The president stood in front of the jet planes. The rubble's all settled and democracy reigns. We defeated their army, taken control, dropped thousands of bombs, and they've taken their toll. The oil's on fire, just like the blood of a billion Muslims dragged through the mud. And the world is safer with the dictator gone, and their lot will improve with our corporate pawn. The war is over. That's what he said, go back to your business. We've buried the dead and the war is over. Fatherless children have taken the street. All that remains is the sting of defeat. Homes are in ruins, cancer is rife. For soldiers and newborns, the end of a life. Kids grown up with just hunger and fear. But lo, behold, the slaves are here. Now all you people are gonna be free, 'cause this land was made for Chevron and me, and the war is over. That's what he said, just turn on your TV. We've buried the dead and the war is over. The government files are all up in flames. His victims of torture, who remembers their names? The past doesn't matter, but the future is bright as the Exxon refinery lights up the night. History's looted like the library's shelves, but we'll fill them with Bibles, be proud of ourselves. Turn your schools into compounds, make room for us all. If you're missing your legs, you can learn how to crawl. The war is over. That's what he said, forget it all happened. We've buried the dead and the war is over. And the price was worth it, yeah, we'd do it again. With bombs or with sanctions, kids, women, and men. 'Cause we have national interests and they must be met. We will enforce them by treaty or jet. And when time has passed and we've had some rest, we'll find a new villain, 'cause that's what we do best. Maybe a sultan or a grandson of Mao, but don't trouble your conscience, because as of now, the war is over. That's what he said, just put it behind you. We've buried the dead and the war is over.
Thank you. I've been too blind to see.
And you're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm Uncle Dennis, and this is From the Cream to the Dregs, sitting in here in the studio tonight. I want to thank Robert for another great show, and he'll be back on Sunday, so tune in then for more Robert Norse and Bathrobe Spirits Broadsides. That'll be 9:30 on Sunday morning. Meanwhile, we're going to be playing rock and roll up until 11 o'clock tonight. And tonight's show is kind of special because it's going to be all vinyl, including some new stuff like this Canned Heat that I found down at a record store the other day. You know, just down there scanning the shelves and what walks in but into my hands, flies into my hands, but some mighty old Canned Heat. So let's just kick back and listen to some more of this stuff.
much time.